This is session four in a series called Writing as Shelter, Growth, and Fruitfulness of Mind. The title of this particular session is Keeping a Journal Yet Again. My name's Nancy Berry. Welcome to you all. Thanks for coming on such a beautiful day. I hope we can make good work of where we are, and I think that the way I want to start is to find out where you are. So the trick to doing that is to have you turn to someone that you don't know, introduce yourself, and talk about whether or not you're a avid journal keeper or a lapsed journal keeper. You might talk about whether or not the kinds of journals that you've kept in your life. That's what I want to spend. I want to do two things today. The first is I want to talk about the varieties in journals that we can keep, the way in which to sort of think about writing as a record of our lives and the flexibilities that journals or day books or diaries or whatever we call them have in helping us along that enterprise. And then the second thing I want to do is talk a little bit about when or why it might happen that you take material from a journal and push it to an audience. Okay, so those are the two things I'd like to do. But let's kind of see where everybody is. Introduce yourself to someone. Talk about journals that you've kept. Talk about why you stopped keeping them, if you stopped keeping them. Talk about whether or not they've served different purposes in your life, and then we'll kind of do a brainstorm here to see where everybody is. Okay? Just give you about a few minutes. Okay, let's rejoin the circle. If I can interrupt you, get you talking, and then tell you to stop. That's not very fair. Hope you met somebody who is interesting to you and that you'll continue the conversation with. Before I forget, I want to recommend four books, two of which are in the bookstore here at Holden, three of which actually. For those of you who, like myself, tend to sort of gather a lot of material before or while I'm doing a project, Natalie Goldberg's Writing Down the Bones, I've talked about a good bit during the week. This book, Ralph Fletcher, Breathing In, Breathing Out, Keeping a Writer's Notebook, is a, Writing Down the Bones is Natalie Goldberg's advice, write fast, write continuously, don't stop, go for the jugular. Ralph Fletcher is a little more encompassing as a writer. He's got lots of quotes by poets and novelists and philosophers, and I'll refer to some of his advice a little bit today. Julia Cameron, The Artist's Way, is a source book on reviving and sustaining a creative spirit within us. She has her model, Natalie Goldberg's model is one notebook a month.
Wow.
One notebook a month.
Wow.
Julia Cameron says three pages a day. Ronald Klug, I just saw this book this week and I'm just barely making my way through it. How to Keep a Spiritual Journal. This is also in the Holden bookstore. This one, and this one are all in the bookstore. And so Klug is definitely after sort of the spiritual angle on this. And before we get to that, I'd like to talk a little more broadly about the kinds of things that people even call these things we call journals. Okay, in the midst of talking about the experience that you've had successfully or not so successfully in keeping an account in writing of your life and your life's work and your mind and your psyche, your spiritual life. What kinds of things? Did anybody call it anything other than a journal? Are there any other words here?
Log.
Logs.
Diary.
Anything else? Any other words? I'm going to throw out a couple here for you. The writer Donald Murray calls it a day book. He doesn't, and I'll talk sort of, I'll wait till I come up with a whole list. Anybody here ever keep a dream journal?
Yep.
Dream journal, right? Sometimes people will have a journal that has to do more with a writer. I'm going to call it a writer's journal, which means that it relates to a particular project that you're working on. It's really kind of like a log. Anything else? I just saw somebody upstairs who said she was really keeping kind of a traveling journal, which is to say that she was 10 minutes every day that she's been on this trip, she's tried to write down what she's done. How are these things different? How are they different? Does it make a difference what we call it? Right? Does it make a difference? I don't know. What do you think?
I think it does.
The staff is a set in your head.
Or a focus.
Mm-hmm. And how are they different? How are they different?
Dichotomy?
Yeah, well, just what, I mean, what's the word diary? How's the word diary different than if you were to keep, well, let's do the obvious one, dream journal?
Yeah.
I would say that, like, if you're keeping a log, that's kind of more like just kind of a list of what you've done during that day. Mm-hmm. Whereas maybe in a diary, you might write about some really interesting thoughts that's why they put locks on them.
The whole thing about locks and secret, right? Anything else about how they're different? How they imply different relationships to the words that you're keeping? Yeah, go ahead.
You might think that there'd be more feeling in a diary than a log.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So this is sort of a record, right? We think of a ship's log, right? Ship's log, as opposed to this, which is personal, which has more feelings attached, which is why, of course, people tend to kind of want to keep it secret when they do. Donald Murray calls it a day book because he keeps it every day, which is where diary comes from, right? The daily record. But to him, it's a real compendium. It's an absolute, just a rack pack of stuff. And in fact, over the years, my journal has become that too. My journal has become both a filing system. I mean, there's a map in here from when I went to Washington, D.C. No, this is from Pennsylvania, Ligonier. There's a brochure from when I went to Washington, D.C. and I saw the Mary Cassatt thing because I wanted to sort of have the material there. So this is, think of also the journal as being a place where you can kind of keep items. Dream journals, anybody here been keeping a dream journal for a while? Dream journals are fascinating to do. I have one. This is the one place where I keep a separate notebook, and it's by my bed, and it's called the dream journal, and it takes me years to fill it up. And I only write in it when, in fact, I've woken up from sleep, and there is something so heavily on my mind from the dream, or of the dream, or through the dream, that I simply record it. It's a particular kind of journal, and those of you who do dream psychology, those of you who know psychologists might want to talk about this, there really is a pattern that can emerge when you work on your dream life. That is to say that psychologists tell me that individuals really can prime themselves to remember dreams more fruitfully, and by recording them, they can make more use of them as an individual. So a dream journal is another way of thinking about it. A writer's journal related to a particular project is when there's really a focus to the work. And I think a traveling journal is something many of us have kept. Again, it's focus and is the places we've been, right? July of 1999, right? Europe, 1972. And so they're organized by place and by time. Most of us, when we talk about a journal, are thinking of something that's broad, expansive, full of stuff. And this is the thing. What kind of stuff is it full of? And why is it that we're driven to do it? Why is it that we're driven to do it? And what effect does it have on our lives if we do it? I mean, why would there be an audience? Mary Nielsen knows this guy, Ronald Klug. He used to work at Augsburg Press, very successful editor. She says he sold 50,000 copies of this book. Very successful. What is it? What is it that compels us to record in whatever form we have, through language, what's going on in our lives? What's at stake? Anybody? Yeah, take a stab. Go ahead.
So you can live life twice.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Memory. Right. Live life twice, create memory through the record. Actually, I mean, think through this a little bit. That the written record takes on a life of its own. A life of its own. And in fact, I would say, you know, there's the life as lived, right? That's biography. And then there's the life as recorded or shaped, right? Which is what happens when our memory kicks in to what we're doing. Other things, other reasons, yeah.
It frees you up.
How so? How
let me push that. How could a sustained habit of disciplined recording of thoughts, desires, memories, reflections, how could that free you?
It's freeing once they're recorded. You no longer have to. You no longer have to keep mulling it over to remember the details. You've recorded them, you know, you're free of it, and if you want to go back to it, you can.
Yeah.
But now it's, you can move on and no longer have to keep remembering the details of it.
Right. That there is a kind of structure and order and now record, just to use that word again. Mm-hmm. And once that's there, no one can take it away from you. No one can take it away from you. You have to learn to respect the integrity of words once they are written. They can be changed. They can be shared or not shared. But once a pattern and an articulation kind of gets on the page, they're yours. They're yours, and they have a life of their own. And that can be freeing. That can be freeing. Anything else? Yeah?
I was going to say that it helps you to look back at how you've changed and grown.
Right, yeah.
Just how everything's changed, your writing, your personality, your feelings, your...
Yeah, call it a growth chronicle. And having a record that is on paper, that exists for 1 year, 5 years, 10 years, 20 years, can be, I guess I would say, as someone who started keeping a journal at the age of 14, and I still have it, and not that I look at it very much, we're going on 30 years now, there is this really weird way in which I can see 30 years. I mean, if you were to just take, you know, December of 1968 and August or July of 1999, you could take that and you'd see that growth. But there's this really weird way in which there's kind of a core of myself that has not changed. It's very subtle, but it's there in a weird way. So there's a way in which the journal or the diary becomes kind of this an articulation of a core, but it does also reflect the way that core has been affected and changed and grown over time. Yeah, who else was going to say something? Somebody else, back slowly.
I guess a couple things come to mind. One is to understand myself. Another is to really know what I'm thinking.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes I don't know really what I'm thinking or how I'm feeling about something until I start writing about it. And then another is that I really use it as prayer.
Mm-hmm.
Prayer,
meditation.
Mm-hmm.
This is a theme we've been talking about all week. People like Goldberg, Peter Elbow, William Stafford, book is also in the bookstore, Writing the Australian Crawl. We do not write from knowledge, we write toward knowledge. We write toward knowledge. That one of the key differences in writing instruction in general and philosophies of teaching folks to write or in helping promote sort of writers, apprentice writers, professional writers, is this notion that writing, we do not have a thought and pour it into words which go on the page. That's not the way it works. We have language, right? We have language, we have material, we have thoughts, we have feelings, we have ideas. But it is only in bringing them to language that the knowledge and the understanding emerges on the page. And there's no better way of kind of keeping track of your intellectual, psychological, and spiritual self than to just let those voices have some space on paper. Okay? Other stuff of why we do it in the back there.
Well, this is a little bit off what she was saying, but a diary can have historical value.
Absolutely.
Where, as opposed to a memoir, it's not as credible.
Yeah. Yeah. That there is history in these texts. There's absolute history. It's the gentleman here who I just saw on the steps, I don't think he's here. So he was talking when we were getting coffee. Where is he?
Gordon?
No, not Gordon. It was elderly... elderly man, but I don't see him here. Anyway, he stopped us because we were talking about keeping a journal, and Sylvie was showing me her journal, and he said his brother and his wife had a set of diaries from 1920 that when they died, their children inherited. And this is what's in there, history. history. Now, most of us don't think of recording history when we write, but if you can imagine, let's see here, we got these titles. If you need these titles, come up afterwards, because I'm going to erase them now. If you think of a model for writing in which there's the self, okay, and then there's the world, all right, very simple paradigm here. But one of the things that you might think about in your reflection are the ways in which this world impinges on the self, and whenever we keep the details of that kind of alive and vivid, we are doing a version of history. I like to think of the journal in this context as sort of your written all things considered. All things considered. All things considered, I remember reading about them when they were doing a history of their show, and they said, you ever had stories that you regret, you know, things you didn't do right? And she said, well, I remember, this is, I don't know whether this was Noah Edwards or who it was, but anyway, he said, we've gotten a lot of flack for different things, and he said, one of the worst days of flack we ever got was the day that there was, what was the accident? Three Mile Island accident, close to nuclear meltdown in the United States. And he said, we did our show, and of course that was the main news story, and we pushed it as, you know, and talked through it as much as we could. And he said, but we had a spot on that show about someone's pie recipe. And he said, we went ahead and did that. And he said, we got a lot of flack for it because people essentially said, you know, well, how, you know, we've almost had a meltdown due to a nuclear accident, and you're talking about pie recipes here on the, you know, 5 o'clock news. And his defense, such as it was that that's the meaning of this phrase, all things considered, and that history comes in both personal, private, and public spheres. And that most of us, when we're doing this work, which is so intensely personal, close to the bone, right? That's what Natalie Goldberg means, writing down the bones, from the self, of the self, for the self, for the self. What we also kind of have to realize is that we don't live in a world just by ourselves, right? There is family, right? There is family, there is work, there's church, there are any varieties of public history that go on all around us. And one of the things that I think is interesting is, this is one of the differences between diaries and journals, is that in some measure of those people who really are rigorous about keeping a daily record, there is a way in which they see themselves as the recorders of the daily stuff, right? That is to say, the weather, something as mundane as the weather, as an account of what was done in the family, who came to visit, who called, who went where. Email. If you have a sustained email conversation with someone that you're just about doing a kind of daily exchange, you might think of that as a kind of diary between you, a collaborative diary, because there is a way, I mean, students at the college, it's fabulous to me. I mean, email has done a lot to make writers of people that probably were writers but weren't quite as disciplined about it. And it is a form of writing. And many students talk about how they're in touch with their parents much more through email. Just this quick 5-minute, here's what happened this morning, went to this class, had this test, stayed up all night, need some money. Parents, it's the same thing. It's the same thing. And depending on how personal or family-oriented it is, as opposed to what is there in the world, you may or may not have within that journal some history, okay? Things as, there's a guy, I don't have the sheet here with me, a guy who actually has started a club for diarists, a kind of group of people who really consider themselves diarists, people who write every day and who are doing it as a record. And he says that he has one of his favorite entries is when he went to New Orleans, and he just recorded everything that was on the menu and how much it costs. And from 1973, he said he got a cup of coffee for 15 cents. And he quotes from it and he says,
hard to believe, but there it is. So that's the diary as the use of record for the unbelieving or the skeptical. Okay, so I appreciate that. History is an important part of it. Other stuff, other uses of them. Yeah.
I use it to help me make decisions.
Yeah.
Doesn't always work.
Yeah. It's a kind of problem solving tool. Right? Problem solving tool, is that fair?
Sounding important.
Yeah, absolutely. And in that scheme, in that same spirit, okay, what you might think about is actually kind of having, thinking about the journal as a place where you have dialogue with yourself or with another person. Here's a kind of diary entry or journal entry that I think is very important. There's one other book I want to recommend, a man by the name of Ira Progoff, P-R-O-G-O-F-F. And he actually has started, has been going on for years, a project called the Journal Workshop. And if you were to go to Ira Progoff's Journal Workshop, you'd literally be given a notebook. You'd be given like a three-ring notebook that's got 12 different divisions in it of kinds of journal entries that you can keep. And one of them has to do with this very thing of what it is to make decisions when you feel that I sort of call this, you know, the wrestling entry. When you feel like there's just something on your mind and we do it in a conversation, well, make a list, pro, con. You know, or think about using the journal as a place to extend the parameters and making a list pro con, to really have a dialogue, right? What would so-and-so say about this? And to actually give in your journal language, create language from people to help you get close to what it is that these others might say to you, particularly if there's a source of conflict, right? What would it mean? What would it mean to have in your journal the space where you could fight with the person that you cannot fight with for one reason or another face to face? Yeah, go ahead.
Well, along that line, writing a letter to somebody that you've never sent.
Okay. Yeah.
And go off.
Yeah. And in fact, there have been times in my life when I was on sabbatical a couple of years ago and I found myself not really keeping the journal, but what I did was I just kept every copy of every letter that I wrote, whether it was an email or a letter. And there are lots of people, when I've done workshops on journals, there are lots of people say, you know, I'm really not much of a journal writer anymore, but I do write very long letters, most of which I send, some of which I don't. But you might think about that, the letter, as a kind of language which can go in the journal, whether it's sent or unsent. Okay. Anything else about what they can do for us? Yeah.
Well, I kept a diary when I was in high school, my freshman, sophomore, and junior year, and I found it, and I still have it. I go back and read it before I teach, and I was amazed at how mature my students were.
So that's an interesting thing, kind of to remind you of a mindset.
That's right. Remind me, put myself back into that position, and then just to look at the world they're in and how they're handling it.
Yeah, and that's a very generous thing, and it's related to this, which I know lots of parents do, which is the record or the chronicle of a child's growth, right? In other words, the journal becomes a way that you can really remember when it happened that your child discovered language, when he or she read their first book, when I know people who are traveling in Britain, and they actually just spent several days in their record, whether it was a specific, you know, day by day journal or not, simply recording how their children, who were very young, picked up British idioms and expressions, and they wanted a record of it so that they could remember. Anything else about why we do this? How it helps?
There's something else that I've just been thinking of, and we've kind of touched on it, but I think that people do this to try to make sure their life means something.
Yeah.
You know, I think that when people die, they want to make sure their life means something. Mm-hmm. And let's face it, I mean, most people who write journals, when you die, nobody's ever going to do anything with it.
Right.
But your interpretation of the day's news, your You're trying to make meaning out of your life. You want your life to mean something.
Yeah.
If you didn't, you wouldn't do this.
Yeah.
If you weren't worried about your life meaning anything, why write it down?
And, you know, you say that's a very interesting question. You know, where does that meaning come from? Does it? And I think the answer is that meaning comes from us. That meaning comes from a sense of the self that we believe has either coherence, and I don't mean coherence that everything's in order and it's all in kind of a package, but it has an integrity. It has an integrity. And that search, I mean, this is what most of the classes that I've been following more than any other have been Roy and Mary Nielsen's on the Enneagram. And this is something that's really parallel to the psychological process that they're describing there. I mean, the Enneagram is based on looking at personality types in relation to how you see yourself and how you see yourself in certain situations and how the world might impact that. And the journal is about, more than I think any other tool, the journal helps us know the self. The journal helps us know the self and know where the self has found meaning. And on days in which, in a life in which we're particularly not certain where that meaning is, or even just that sometimes, you know, we just feel that it goes too fast. It all just goes too fast. I'm particularly struck by that at Holden this past week because this is the first time here, and I would never have guessed how being in a place with no telephone, no radio, no television, no daily mail, those four things absent from my life have created this space, which I think if you keep a journal, you can purposely create too, but you got to clear away a lot of noise. You got to clear away a lot of noise, a lot of noise. And I think that's what consistent writing over time as a discipline gives us. It gives us space to create our own meaning and to just kind of clear outside all of that activity and purposefulness and work and family and play. I mean, all that good stuff. It's not all bad stuff. It's good stuff. But writing as a sustained activity is a place where it gets still and you write toward meaning. And I think there's some real power in that. Anything else I want to say about this? Does it matter what kind of book you write in? Let me do this. Let's do this. Those of you who said you stopped or you gave it up, you quit, why is it that sometimes we write in journals and sometimes we don't? What's going on with that? And I'm an intermittent journal keeper. As I said, I keep lots of different books. I've got, you know, the dream journal. I've got kind of files, folders with notes for writing projects I want to do. So it's my writing life is a mess, okay? And sometimes the journal is like sort of the best friend that I have and the best kind of thing that I've got. And other times, I can't even find it. Why is that? What happens?
I'm not sure.
I'm sorry?
It's a chore.
It's work.
It's work.
It is work. I've said that all week. Writing is physical labor. We don't think of it that way, but it is. And the best advice I found from writers about dealing with that is those writers who say, don't set yourself up for a chore that's going to kill you. That is to say, go with these short intervals of nonstop writing. You know, if you write for 10 minutes, we did that the first couple days here. If you write for 10 minutes nonstop, you can write a lot of stuff. Yeah, David.
I think another problem is that many of us think we're going to do our writing at the end of the day.
Mm-hmm.
And the end of the day comes at 1 a.m. and we're too tired or there's
right.
something else that has to get done.
Right.
All of a sudden we've gone for a week and haven't written anything.
That's right, yeah. And I think that there's something, and I think that's kind of because it's work and because we know that it's going to require this sort of settling, you know? And I think that's the other reason we say, I don't have time for that yet. Julia Cameron's the best one. She says 3 pages every day first thing. You know, that you got to do it first thing. If you don't do it first thing, then it gets... And I think the best paradigm to pay attention to in your life is when you have found that energy and have learned how to do that every day. And you know that it's just by saying, I'll just do it. It becomes part of the day. Whether you run or exercise or pray or do meditation, Anybody who does a practice like that will tell you it becomes part of the way you live your day each day, right? Yeah, go ahead.
I was just going to say, when you said that, journaling in the morning, one of the reasons I journal before bed is because that helps me sleep better.
Yeah, that is good. I know a woman who did that as well. She was I think she would probably call it a diary that she kept, but she was that way. She said, every night it's the last 30 minutes that I do. I write in my diary. Anything else about why we give them up, or we put them aside, or we kind of get away from them? Yeah.
Well, I have kind of a whole bookshelf of journals, and I find that my life is either outer-directed or inner-directed. And when it's inner-directed, it's really easy to get those out. And other times, I am so out of focus. Then I may see a pretty book, or I may have some thoughts, and I think, oh, I will get the journal in my queue. I can't find my old one.
Right.
But
right.
I came house in May, and I found a whole bunch.
That's right. Yeah, everybody who's got one with them physically, let's just hold them up kind of to see the variety, you know? It's like they're just different books. They're just different. And, you know, every writer, you know, Fletcher and Klug and, you know, Natalie Goldberg, she's great. She says, I like to get those spiral notebooks that only cost 25 cents at the start of the school year. And I like to get ones that have really goofy covers, like, you know, Mickey Mouse and, you know, cartoon characters. She said, because it's hard to take yourself too seriously when you open up a 25-cent spiral notebook that's got a picture of Daffy Duck on it. Because that's her encouragement to us as writers. I've erased these things, but her encouragement to us is to sort of, to go for the jugular and to go for the uncensored self, and to let loose. This is the paradox about writing, to let loose what we discover without putting very many stakes on it. I mean, all this stuff that we've put here, this is serious stuff, right? This is negotiating the self and the world. This is negotiating the self with the self and of the self. But a lot of writers who keep journals and who admonish us or encourage us to do it, they say, you know, you gotta keep yourself from taking all this writing too seriously. Too seriously. You've got to recognize that the journal is like a compost heap of material and stuff. And so if you know, it's a collection of ideas and thoughts, but that doesn't mean you're writing the great American novel. Right? Anything else about why we get hung? I do think one of the things that happens is that we get, this is where the word diary is really a hang-up. I think I've known writers and myself too, that if you think of yourself as in the practice of keeping a diary or keeping a journal, and then you get off track, and your life sort of changes direction, and the same thing happens to people who, you know, who exercise or who meditate every day. I used to run every day, but then, I don't know, something happened, I kind of got on a different groove, and now I don't do it anymore. There's a way in which then we attach all this stuff about getting back to it. Right, and so then when we look at writing, we say, oh, you know, I stopped for a while. Why did I give it up? Now I feel guilty. I guess I'm not a very good writer, am I? And then it becomes this kind of tug of war about, well, if I were really serious about it, I would be doing it every day. And I guess I'm not, so then I just won't do it anymore. And one of the key lessons that I want to say about the practice of writing is you're either doing it or you're not. And you don't need to spend, I don't think we need to spend a lot of energy explaining why or understanding why. As a practice, like meditation, like spiritual work, it will always open up to us when we come to it. When we come to it. You know, I mean, think about it in your prayer life. It's not as if if there's been a time in your life when you've not prayed, you know, and you just have felt the sort of separation between yourself and the divine. It's not as if when you go to the divine says, where have you been? And that's how you know that writing is art, because it invites you to enter into it wherever you are, whenever you are. So I really encourage those of you who have kind of, you know, thought, oh, I used to do that, but I gave it up, and I can't do it every day. That's my point. I can't do it every day, so I guess I can't do it at all. It's bullshit. It doesn't make any sense. You do it when you do it, and it has meaning and integrity as you do it. And if it is a practice that does all of these things for you, it will become a rich and fertile part of how you live in the world. So that, I mean, and this is true, if you were to go a day or 2 days without writing, you'd say, ooh, where is myself? Where am I? What kind of a day was it? Okay? I just want to read for you real quickly here what Ron says about this. I mean, he's talking about a spiritual journey, and I do think that's important. One of the things that's not come up enough in this is the journal as a place for play. Word play, pictures, jokes, things you like. I once knew a young guy, he was a young boy, he was like 12 or 13, he had a postcard collection. I said, Paul, let me see your postcard collection. He had this great index, few bucks, and was full of all these postcards. And, you know, they were all arranged by state. It was very impressive, actually. They were arranged by state, and one of them was, lived in Iowa, and he had a picture of the Cedar Rapids Mall. I don't know if any of you know Iowa, but if you know Iowa and you know Cedar Rapids, you know that the Westdale Mall in Cedar Rapids is not the kind of place that you'd think to have a postcard of. And I did. I laughed. I said, what is this? This is the Cedar Rapids Mall? And he just kind of looked at me, and he said, well, I don't know. He said, I guess I kind of liked it there. And I thought, well, sure, absolutely. You know, who am I to laugh? You liked it there, you keep a postcard of it, you know? And I think that's the thing. It's a place to keep what you love, what you feel connected to. And sometimes that can be pictures. It can be literally physical pictures of things. It can be more like, and then you say, well, that's not a journal, that's like a scrapbook. But see, this is sort of one of the key things in my lesson here, such as it is that to think of the journal as expansive, not as this narrow thing of only words, right? Got to write them every day, got to use lined paper, you know, got to check the spelling, got to lock it up at night. Think of it as this expansive thing, where sometimes to keep the self for that day, you want a picture. Or you want a brochure from an art gallery because the exhibit knocked your socks off. Or you want a quote. I mean, just imagine what it would mean to keep a journal entry in which all you did was record the things that people had said to you that day that either made you laugh, pissed you off, or just kind of made something in your head go, oh, yeah. Right? My impetus here is to get us to expand what we think can go in a journal, because the self is more, and this is the whole thing about the Enneagram, the self is more complicated than we give it credit for. The self is more complicated, more varied, all things considered, right? Life is full of disasters, near disasters, tragedies, and pie recipes. and the journal should be a place in which we give voice to all of that. All of that. So if, as you're writing, you know, and the stakes seem high and it's close to the bone and you feel like it's real serious, you know, think about today I'm just going to try and record in my journal funny stuff, goofy stuff, right? And if you can't think of any, well, then just cut something from a newspaper or quote something that you thought was funny, because all of that is our self and a version of ourself. Okay. Anything else in this big thing that I'm trying to expand and make more flexible? Yeah, go ahead.
Well, two thoughts. I keep a journal, but I keep it on notebook paper, and then at the end of the year, I buy a big 3-inch notebook and keep all kinds of things. One of the things that I keep at the end of the year, last couple of years, is I put in people's Christmas letters.
Oh yeah.
Printed out letters.
Right.
They all go in for that year, but when the O.J. trial was going on, I lived in L.A., so it was big news,
right.
And they had a regular column of jokes about the trial.
Yeah.
I was very deliberate in cutting those out every day and putting them in there.
Yeah.
Because it was just so ridiculous.
Right, right. And that's, I think, a good thing to think about, as the journal is a place to record the sublime and the ridiculous. Because that's part of who we are. Yeah, Soleil.
Could you talk about writing with your non-dominant hand?
Oh, I have it right now, but do you want to describe doing that?
Well, I've done that at times, and basically you just write with whatever hand you're, you know, and I've been shocked.
At what? at literally the language that you find by using a hand you're not used to writing with.
I mean,
yeah.
What I would say, I would never in a million years think I would say.
Right.
Or say with my right hand.
Yeah. And yeah, that's like, I've drawn with my non-dominant hand when I've done, and this is something that I would encourage you to do. Visualize stuff in your journal. You know, don't think of journal just as language words, but pictures. That is to say, sketches and drawings. You know, if you're really in the middle of a problem, it's really useful to put it, if I were going to draw a picture of this problem, what would it be? I have students do this in literature classes with plots of novels. I say, draw a picture of the plot of this novel. And they look at me at first like I'm crazy, and I say, well, it's not. You're trying to conceptualize the story, and you're trying to do it in language that's not word language, right? So that's, okay, but that's a digression from what you said. Why do you use the non-dominant hand? Because you want to tap into a part of you that is not the conscious, overly determined, lives in the world, always has a public face, is perfectly adult, well-mannered, polite, you know. And most of us say, well, that's not what my journal's for either. But I think the point is, it's there. I mean, the older we get, the more we live in the world, the more that's the other space. Right? To find out parts of you that you didn't even know were there. Yeah, that's an excellent point.
I'd be afraid I might stutter the rest of the day.
Oh, you mean just because it was so... Yeah.
No, didn't they used to say in the old days that if the teacher made you write with your non-dominant hand, it'd make you stutter?
Yeah, but isn't that crazy? I mean, you know, I guess that's in the days in which...
Yeah.
I mean, I think I always wanted to know, how did they know, really? I mean... You know, hey, go ahead. In the back, gentlemen in the back.
If the non-dominant hand produces different work, then does it stand to reason that if you journal on a computer, it's different?
Oh,
sure. Some people have theorized that.
Some people have theorized that, and some people, I know people who, you know, when I've really been in writer's block, people have said to me, Nancy, just talk it into a tape recorder. Give up, you know, if you just feel like you can't get the words down, just talk into a tape recorder. And so that's another way of sort of saying, well, you know, if you change the medium, do you change the line? Do you actually change the stuff? And I guess that probably is fair to say that the different media will draw on different aspects of ourself. And, you know, some people, I know people who at this point, especially at this point in time, they just don't even like to write anymore. I mean, they're so facile with word processing and typing that if you say to them, keep a handwritten journal, they say, oh, I don't even like to write anymore. It's all keyboard work. Now, whether that's different than what they record on paper, you know, it might be, but who knows? And then what's so funny, they say, well, I can't keep a journal because I just use only keyboard now. I say, well, do keyboard entries. Yeah. Oh, I can do that? This is the thing that's so funny. You know? There are no rules about this. There are no rules about it. It is a text for you. It has whatever integrity you give it to in your life. It's a practice. It's a practice, like any other practice, a spiritual practice of prayer and meditation, a health practice like exercise and walking, intellectual practice like reading, right? Writing is a practice, and it's a way then that you deliberately move toward making yourself centered or at least grounded in language or playful in language, just as exercise or prayer does. Okay, last comment, then one more thing. Yeah,
well, you talked about the stuttering. That's not so out of reach. Our daughter, who was kindergarten, was a left-hander. She went into first grade, and she was a right-hander.
Yeah.
And we wondered about that.
Mm-hmm.
But then she started coming home and throwing up after school. Mm-hmm. I was home, so I could know what was going on. Day after day after day, this happened. When we went in for conferences, I asked her about this left-handed, right-handed. I said, have you been trying to make her do right-handed work? She said, no. She came into the grade, and that was what she was doing, and I just assumed that's what she was.
Mm-hmm.
I said, well, she was left-handed last year, now she's sick when she gets home from school. And so I said, well, we are not trying to make her be left-handed at home, and we would appreciate if you would experiment this in school and encourage her that this is not out of line. The reason she was doing it is that she didn't want to be different.
Yeah.
We did ask her.
Sure.
But once she was comfortable going back to the left hand, she was well.
Yeah, that's just,
So it is serious stuff. I appreciate it.
It is serious.
And that was in first grade. Had we not stopped at that point, who knows what would have happened to that.
And you know, I think that's a very telling story. I want to say two things about it. The first is, it's a very telling story about how fragile our relationship to language is. Even something as physical as which hand we use. I can't tell you how many people I know who, you know, you say to them, oh, they say I used to like to write, and then I had this teacher, you know, and, oh, man, you know. And I don't know whether it's because it is creative activity that is such at the core of the self, but it is one of those things that's very delicate. You know, the image I use is you got to imagine someone as a writer doing any artistic activity or practice, really, any practice, that it's just the most delicate seedling you've got there when you start. I mean, think about it. You know, whether it's prayer, whether it's running the first time you run. I mean, those of you who run every day, you know, before I ran, you know, this is years ago. I mean, I couldn't do a mile. I was overweight. I was out of shape. I mean, it took a lot to get that seedling in me that wanted to kind of do that. And writing is the same way. And all of these things kind of enter in and apply pressure to it. You know, use the right hand. Even self, I'm not doing it the way I should. How many of you have said that to yourself? I'm not doing this the way I should. You've got to give that space for the creative activity to grow. And people around you, coaches, writing groups, friends, parents, if your children are doing this, people don't need advice when they're doing creative activity. They need support and they need time. And they don't really even need applause. They really don't. They need to be taken seriously in the practice. That's what we need. We need to be taken seriously in the practice. And you know, just to have someone pay attention enough. The second thing I want to say about that is another book here, Gabriella Rico, Writing the Natural Way. This is a wonderful writing book. Writing the Natural Way, R-I-C-O, Gabriella Rico. And she has developed this whole thing of left brain, right brain work and why it is that you might want to use your non-dominant hand and how it is that tapping into the other half of your brain can do that. Okay, last little bit that I want to say here. When does it happen, or why does it happen, that sometimes what's in the journal, we want to go tell, how many of you, let's just do the show of hands, how many of you have had moments when something in your journal you've wanted to have go reach a wider audience? Anybody here ever? A couple people? How many of you really feel that it's yours and yours alone? Okay, there's no rule. If you keep writing over a period of time and you want it to be yours, you gotta just keep it in a place where you know it's only yours. And if they're in a box somewhere and you really don't want other people to read them, you gotta take responsibility for making sure that doesn't happen. That is to say, the writing is always ours, and we're the ones who decide. Other people may say, well, can I read your journal? It's your decision. Sometimes what I have done when somebody's asked that, I said, well, no, I don't want you to read the journal, but let me just read you this one sentence from what I wrote today. And sometimes that can kind of, there is something, if you live in a house and you're the writer in the house, and the kids say, well, are you writing about me? Or your spouse or partner says, you know, are you, why is it you're always writing? There's Anna Quinlan, you know Anna Quinlan, a wonderful columnist turned novelist. She won a Pulitzer Prize for her work in the New York Times column, first Life in the 30s and then Public to Private, or Public and Private, Private and Public. Anyway, her husband one time just said to her, especially because her early columns, Life in the 30s, were very autobiographical, very much about her family. She's Irish, she's Catholic, she's got kids. Her husband at one point just kind of looked at her and said, you know, I really would like to ask you to go into the kitchen and get me a can of beer, but I gotta say, if I ask you to do that, will you promise me you won't write about it in your column? And of course, so she did. I mean, that's how I know about it, because then she went on to write about it in her column. So I guess she said, well, no, I don't know what she said. I think what it is when people see us writing, you know, and they recognize that it's a record and they recognize that there's material there,
And I don't, you know, I don't really know whether or not they want physically to have the thing handed over, although sometimes there can be an issue of control there and a real power struggle. But I think there is a way, if it does feel very private and you want to kind of open it up to this person that you're sharing a relationship with, or you've got in a family or a household or a partnership, there is a way in which you can let them into it by saying, you know, I want to read you this line. You know, I just want to kind of, and there is some work that can be done from this. I know a woman, I taught a teaching workshop years and years ago, and she was inspired by the whole journal thing. They kept what was called a family journal. And the family journal was a spiral notebook that sat in the kitchen. She had three children, husband and wife, and she decided that it was a family journal. And there were like two rules. And the first rule was no making fun of other people in the family. In other words, no using the journal to kind of snipe at other people in the family. And then the other rule was don't write anything in the journal that's so personal you don't want everyone in the family to read. In other words, the other rule was anyone in the family can come in and look at this book and add to it. And she had, one of her oldest was a son, and he was about 14, 15, and he thought it was the stupidest idea he'd ever heard in his life. And she said, but the younger children were both girls, and they were 8, you know, and 9, 10, or 8, you know, and they thought it was great. And so, you know, they would write. And she said it took about 3 weeks that the son, she said, she realized, she heard him down in the kitchen, and she realized that he would come down every night and he'd read. And after about 3 weeks, he actually started to put some things in it. And so it was a way for the family. And she said, actually, it was the family journal. And it was a place for them to resolve conflict. And in fact, to kind of, you know, again, you couldn't put anything in it that was just between you and mom, right? But if you felt like there was something that happened in the family that was unfair or that bothered you and you wanted everybody to know about it, there it went. Okay, what is it? So think about, if it's yours, keep it yours. It has an integrity. Nobody else has to answer to it. If you want at some point for someone else to have access to it, that's your decision. And this is what's very fascinating to me. Real quickly, I'll finish up here with a story. People who have kept journals for years and years and years, some of them, particularly women, for whom this kind of writing, I mean, there's a whole feminist critique here, which I haven't gotten into much, but women for whom this kind of writing was the genre of writing that was allowed, right? This was the way women could keep track and do participate in a literary culture through the diary. There is a time in which those writers come to a sense of, I want it to go out. I want it to go out. The best illustration I have is a woman in Iowa named Emily Hawley Gillespie. Kept a 30-year diary from 1855 to 1885. She lived near Manchester, Iowa. And Emily Gillespie kept this record daily, her diary, she called it her friend. It was a record of her life as a pioneer farm wife, very troubled marriage that disintegrated into real violence at some moments. And about year 25, you can see her, first of all, give portions of it to her daughter and ask her daughter to copy it over. And you see her making a decision that she wants the diary to go to her daughter and she wants it to become a record that her daughter has. This is similar to poet Emily Dickinson. Emily Dickinson did not publish many poems. People say that there are theories about that. But Emily Dickinson was very deliberate about how she wanted her poems arranged. She stitched them into small books. They were called fascicles. And she was very deliberate about wanting these poems to be arranged a certain way. And I think that if it happens that over the course of your writing life, you really feel there's something in the journal that wants to go out, my best advice is to lift it from the journal, right? To lift it from the journal and give it some space, like a transplant or a graft or a seedling, into a poem or a story or an actual family history or a memoir or something else. In other words, you know, people who keep journals, you know, and they say, well, what do I do with them? I got 30 notebooks. And I say, well, what do you want to do with them? I say, well, I just think there's some stuff in there that's interesting. Well, then take it as a project to read them as a reader might, and to see where those places, and use this phrase this week, where the center of gravity kind of draws your attention as a reader, and you want to take that and then give it some form outside the journal, right? You take it from a record of the self and you give it some identity as a text that's going to live in the world. Does that make sense to you?
Yeah.
But you have to realize that that's not a violation of the journal. The journal will always abide as it is. You've got the record. And you need to respect the integrity of that. That's the record that you made. That was the entry as it existed. But if you want readers to be able to come to it, you got to do some work to have it make that transition from writing, you know, from the self and of the self and for the self to writing that exists in the world for readers who did not live through that moment as you did. Last comments or questions there? Anything else? Well, do you think you have it in you to do an entry? You don't have to do one right now, but I think, you know, I was thinking before the class, I thought, what would be the worst thing that would happen? Oh, Nancy, the worst thing that would happen is anybody would leave this class and they'd never write in their journal again. So I hope the main thing is to just kind of a little impetus there. And to recognize that as a medium, as a space, it is as flexible as it comes. It's a canvas, it's a chronicle, it's a history book, it's a spiritual account, right? Very based on the Puritan tradition in that, you know, this notion of keeping track of the life of the soul. Why? Well, in the Puritan scheme, keeping track of the life of the soul was necessary because you always wanted to know whether or not you were on the right side or the wrong side of God. If that's the way you want to live your spiritual life, of course, those stakes are high. I say it's keeping track of the soul because keeping track of the soul is to make sure it's always a part of you, that it's a way of kind of keeping track of this inner self that is struggling to find its way in the world, left-handed or right-handed, you know? It's very basic stuff, really. It's not very complicated.
As I sit and listen to you, you're so free to the whole enterprise in so many tricky ways. And I'm thinking about, Sylvia, I don't journal, but I'm thinking back, because I've had it for years, but I'm thinking back at various times where I have done journal-like things.
Mm-hmm.
Blogging, for example.
Mm-hmm.
What are you doing that for?
Yeah.
And then I would critique it to the point of, what am I doing this for? And let it go.
Yeah.
But I can see that I've dabbled along the years with doing this, and then somebody invariably comes up, are you wasting your time on that when you got this? People can be so powerful in their critique of one's search for letting one's own self through.
That is excellent. Say that again.
I don't know if I can.
I know, but people can be so powerful in critiquing
your attempts to set your own self free.
Your attempts to set your own self free. Everybody should write that down in their journal right now. People can be so powerful in their attempts to critique, or in their critiquing of your attempts to set your own soul free and your own self free. And that's why we got to protect it. You know, that's why that image of the seedling. Think about the seedling. And even if you say, I don't know why I'm doing it. I don't know why I'm doing it, but it's not harming anybody. You know, of all the activities out there that exist in the world, this is a pretty harmless practice. I guess that's where I am with it. That we live in a culture that's really not interested. I mean, this is sort of soapbox time. But we live in a culture that's really not interested in people setting their souls free. You know, they want us to work hard. They want us to raise our children to be good citizens. They want us to pay our taxes. I mean, it's a big world. There are lots of people in it. You gotta get in line. But really, you know, who gives permission to set the soul free? We do.
And I think it comes out sideways, and I'm evaluating myself, and I see one of the ways it's come out sideways is I let things accumulate.
Yeah.
scraps of this.
And yeah.
Piles of that kind of stuff that other people would call junk.
Yeah.
But I abandoned the task of reflecting on them, and I just became a collector of them.
Yeah.
Julia Cameron, have you looked at Julia Cameron's book, The Artist's Way? I'd encourage you to look at that, because it is, you know, everything today, it's not just a book, it's a workbook, it's, you know, but the book is good, and it's worth checking out in the library. She has this thing, you make an artist date with yourself. If you want to nurture the creative spirit in you, you make a date with it once a week. You say, today, for this part of me that loves art, I'm going to go to a museum.
Gives you an excuse to do it.
That's right. Somebody else was going to say something here.
Yeah. I was just going to say that journaling is to me, one more thing on a list of things that are really good to do for yourself, and how many of us, you know, make that a priority.
Yeah, that's true.
You know, not journaling, but things that we do for ourselves.
That's right. So, care of the soul is what Thomas More called it, right? Mm-hmm. Care of the soul. Any other things to end on? Okay, thank you all. Good luck, good writing lives. I wish you good writing lives.